NW from Winnipeg. May I first of all express my sincere thanks to Jerry and Marg, and through Jerry to Jim, the conference chairman, and to all the wonderful people on the committee for having invited me. I am deeply honored and so much appreciate the opportunity of sharing with you for a while this afternoon. I take a look around and I see so many faces that are familiar to me, some of them from Winnipeg, some of them from Winnipeg and now from Calgary, some of them already in Calgary, some of them from Victoria, which suggests to you that I have been on a geographical tour of some type. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention my dear, dear friends, Ramsey and Gladys, who are visitors with us this afternoon. I had the privilege of having lunch with them, and Ramsey picked up the tab, and that was really nice. And I'm so grateful that they saw fit to take the time to join us this afternoon. At a public information meeting, we try to convey something about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have heard a little bit so far about Alateen and Al-Anon, and it becomes my task, I suppose, to talk a little bit about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. There are a couple of things I think that I would like to say first of all. The first is this, that I'm directing my remarks really to those of you in the audience who are visitors, to those of you that might be looking at the AA program for the first time. Because I think that in doing so, I would be remiss if I didn't say that this is not an intellectual exercise. This is a feeling program. This is a program of love. It's a program of sharing. And a program of caring. And a program of hopefully being part of a solution rather than part of a problem. I'm taking my watch off here so I can keep an eye on it. That's a lesson I learned last night from Hillary. Thank you, Hillary. And so to you visitors and newcomers, we usually, when we have an opportunity to share with you, we usually begin by introducing ourselves. And I will do so by telling you that my name is Grant, and I am a very, very grateful alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I used to say that I was a recovered alcoholic, and then somebody caught me on that and said, no, you haven't recovered. You're recovering. So I started to say I'm a recovering alcoholic, and some of my other friends came and said, no, you've recovered. So I've stopped using the two words, and I'm quite comfortable with both of them. I feel that as of today, I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless illness. I can bet money on it that I'm not going to drink from now till bedtime. So I think for today, I've recovered. But I'm also comfortable with the idea that I'm recovering from a seemingly hopeless illness. I'm hoping that I'm a little better today than I was yesterday. So I'm recovering. I'd like to take just a moment or two to talk in a general sense because of the fact that it's a public information meeting. But in truth, we really have only one story, those of us that are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't stand up here in any official capacity. I am simply a member of AA. I have one story to tell, and that's my own story. And it's a story of what I used to be like, and what happened to me, and what I am like now. But I think it is important to talk about a couple of things, because it is a public information meeting, before I launch into my own personal story. One of the things that we're often asked in AA, and particularly if you're talking to a non-AA group, they get all hung up on things like definition. Now, what's the definition of alcoholism? And we don't really care in AA, you know. If you're sick enough and puking enough, I guess you qualify, you know. But nevertheless, it's important to look at it. I've got a couple of definitions that I kind of enjoy. There's one of the fellow that came to, and he was sitting on the edge of the bed, and he had one shoe off and one shoe on. And he didn't know whether he was taking them off to go to bed or putting them on to get up. When I lived in Regina, we had a psychologist there who was doing a study. At that time, I worked for the Alcoholism Commission in Saskatchewan. And my good friend Tom is here somewhere in the crowd, employed with the commission. But this psychologist came in one day and he said, "Grant, I've got the definition for alcoholism." And I said, "Great, let's hear it." He said, "It's a biosocial system of maladaptive behavior." I said to him, "That's great, but if I go into a doctor and he asks me what's wrong and I tell him that I'm suffering from a biosocial system of maladaptive behavior, is he going to know what I mean?" Have you heard that song? It was popular a year or two ago. And it starts out by saying, "I find myself in a world where I don't belong. And I'm not that strong." And I thought to myself, you know, that's us. That's the alcoholic. Isn't it true when we're boozing it up? What we're really trying to do is escape something. We're trying to escape from a world where we don't belong. And we're not that strong. But I suppose in a general way, alcoholism is a condition that affects men and women in equal shares. Take your pick. And it doesn't matter about the color of your skin. It doesn't matter about your particular religious background, if indeed you have a religious background at all. It doesn't matter whether you're tall or short or fat or skinny or whether you believe in God or not. If you consume alcohol and you suffer from a continuing and growing problem in the business of living, that's alcoholism. And I guess that kind of qualifies me. AA has no official interpretation. I don't stand here, again speaking to the visitors and newcomers, I don't stand here to interpret the AA program to you. Every AA member in this room has a different concept of that program. Kind of a remarkable thing when you think about it. There's no party line. Nobody sends down edicts from on high that this week this is what we're going to talk about. It doesn't work that way. There's no dogma, no creed. Nobody's asking you to sign a pledge. We heard what was read at the outset about the nature of the AA program, and if you will recall the words that were spoken, the only condition for membership in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is a desire to stop drinking. We're self-sufficient by our own contributions. Here we are in a beautiful convention center, and this is indeed a beautiful building. We paid the whole shot from the money out of our own pockets. We don't hold tag dates. We don't go trotting off to the government for a handout. In fact, if somebody has a feeling of beneficence and wants to give us money, we have to turn it down because our traditions say that we are self-supporting. And I think that's kind of wonderful. And when we talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, we talk about things like fellowship. We talk about things like sharing. We help each other. And we love each other. And finally, there's a spiritual dimension to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me not downplay this part of the program. This is a spiritual program, not a religious program. We can all understand that if you have your own particular religion, there's likely a church nearby that you can attend if it is your wish to do so. But when we talk about a spiritual program, what we're talking about are intangibles. We're talking about the things that are felt rather than the rules and the regulations and the buildings and the trappings that might go along with some religious organization. It's the feeling that exists in this room. And I'd like you to think about this as I launch into my story. Not so much about what I say, but the feelings that are created in this room. I can tell you that there is a force in this room, and it exists in every room where a group of Alcoholics Anonymous meet. Most of us come to recognize that force as being a higher power, a God of our understanding. Okay, I said a few minutes ago that I talk about what I used to be like, what happened, and what I am like today. Now, it's very important for me to mention this to you, that what I'm talking about is not what you see. See, I'm going to brag a little bit. I think I look all right this afternoon. Thank you. Got on my best speaking suit. Got on a clean shirt, clean socks, new tie. Even have on clean shorts. They're a little tight, mind you, but they're clean. So I don't want you to take a look at the outside. That doesn't really mean too much. Let me tell you something else. I've got this mop of white hair now, and I belong to the Southside group in Winnipeg. Yeah, there we are. Yeah, there we are. And I had my belly button birthday in September. And we had a meeting on a Tuesday night, and I happened to mention to one of the people that belonged to the group that it was my birthday the next day. So a couple of days later, I was talking to another person, and they said, geez, we got talking about you and how old you are. We were trying to figure out what your age was. Well, the good news was that somebody said I was 43. And the bad news is that somebody said I was 63. Now, I'm going to leave you guessing. I'm not going to tell you how old I am. You can figure it out for yourself. But what I'm talking about this afternoon is how I feel inside, what I used to be like. Happened to me, it was good luck, and if something bad happened, that was par for the course. I was a skinny kid. At the age of 14, I was 6 feet tall. I looked like a noodle. When I used to go swimming, you know, I'd start to pull on my bathing shorts. If I happened to look in the mirror and stick out my tongue, my ribs sticking out, I looked like a zipper. I always felt that people expected more of me than I was able to give. Those of you that happen to be tall that are in this audience will identify with this. But as a kid, at school, for example, the teacher would say to me, a big boy like you ought to know better than that. Now you tell me why a big boy of 14 or 15 should know more than a little boy of 14 or 15. But that was the kind of pressure I found myself under. I'm a perfectionist. I have to do everything perfectly by God, or I'm not going to do it. I have to work on this today. This is not something that I had then and I don't have now. I always felt that people were expecting more of me than I was able to give. These are the kinds of things that took place inside of myself. Outwardly, I think I looked okay. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about what it's like inside. And you see, when I was introduced to alcohol, and if you've got all those funny feelings inside, alcohol has a remarkable effect. It gets rid of all those funny feelings. So it wasn't too long before I discovered that if I wanted to feel better, all I had to do was get a couple of shots in me, and things would start to look better. Now, nobody told me in those days that that is an early sign of a developing problem. Nobody told me that when I sort of drank everybody under the table and drove everybody home after a party, that that was a sign of a problem. I just thought that I could really hold the stuff. I thought I was a two-fisted drinker. I was born and raised in Winnipeg, attended school, high school there, joined the Air Force for 2 or 3 years. They wouldn't take me in air crew because I've only got one eardrum. The doctors laugh. They get looking in this ear, and I say, what are you laughing at? And they say, there's a hole in your head. I don't have any eardrum. So I served as an airframe mechanic, which has to be the laugh of the century, because I'm one of those guys that if you send me out for a left-handed hammer, I go looking for it, you know. I'm really bright when it comes to that kind of thing. I served 2 or 3 years in the Air Force, came out, and I have to tell you that I was really big on decision-making. That's another one of my problems. My brother sat down with me. I can remember this very clearly. We sat down at a coffee bar one day. We're sipping on a cup of coffee, and after I'd been in the Air Force for this period of time and I'd built up some gratuities, he said, what are you going to do with the money that you earned while you were in the Air Force? And I said, I don't know. I shrugged. He said, why don't you go to university and take law? And I said, okay. That's how you make big decisions in your life, you see. So I went to the university and I attended law school and I graduated with a degree in law and I worked for a while in southwestern Manitoba in the oil business, land titles work. Then I went with a life insurance company for a while in its legal department. Then I practiced law for a while in Winnipeg. All this time I'm drinking, but it's no big deal. I think that I've got it under control. Except that it's answering all my problems as I have already described to you. Then I moved up to Swan River, Manitoba, and that's where I really cut loose. Now, I've heard people talk about their drinking experience, and they kind of go on about it gets real morbid. They start talking about, suicide and all these things, and my story isn't very pleasant either as I get into it and as I'm going to tell you in a few moments. But I have to tell you this, that in the early days of my drinking, it was a ball. By God, I really enjoyed myself. I play the piano a little bit, and that's a great way to live it up at a party. You can get bashing away on that piano, and they line the booze up on the top of the piano, and the more booze that I got into me, the better that I thought I was. No, Mike? You mean I've been talking all this time and you haven't heard me? Is it coming through? Do I have to shout? Okay. Geez, you scared me for a minute. I thought I'd had all those words of wisdom going to waste, for heaven's sake. Anyway, I play the piano and they get the booze lined up, and the more I played, the better I thought I became on the piano. And all the great party songs. I love to tell this part of my story because it's kind of fun, you know. But we sing all the old songs like Good Night Irene and 5'2" and Side by Side, you know, all the old numbers. And I'd play a number like 5'2" and I'd be half in the bag and I'd think, Jesus, I did a good job on that number. And after we were through, everybody would be clapping and saying, hey, that's great, Grant. Let's have another number. And then some idiot would say, yeah, how about playing 5'2"? You know, we're in the legal profession, we're called barristers and solicitors. Not me. I was a bar rester. And they say that we practice law, and I did. I literally practiced it. That's about all I can say for it. If you were to come into my office at 9:30 in the morning and said, let's have a drink, I was long gone. It didn't matter the time of day. I would drink any time. That was my particular pattern. I used to have a sign that I taped on my door back in 15 minutes. Every once in a while, I'd run back in and move the sign. It looked like I'd been in for a while, and then I'd be gone again. You stop to think of it, you don't know when the 15 minutes started. I was appointed a police magistrate and a juvenile court judge. In those days, the youngest in the province of Manitoba, a part-time job. I continued to have my law practice, and this was a part-time thing. I don't mention that for any other reason other than the fact that as I got into the real boozing, I can say this without fear of contradiction, that I was the only magistrate, not in Manitoba, not in this fair country of ours, not in the North American continent or the Western Hemisphere or the world or the universe or anywhere. I was the only magistrate who had a still in his basement. And as surely as I stand here, we, three of us, we mixed up our own booze, and I'll tell you, it was the most beautiful stuff that you've ever drank. White lightning. It was great. But you know, things go from bad to worse, and my story is no different than any other AA member in this room. I started to, on the toboggan slide towards alcoholism. And I got mired into alcoholism long before I ever came to you people. And that was part of my problem, because while I was mired there, I started to get into trouble in all the other areas of my life. My family relationships began to suffer. I wasn't looking after the law practice. The only thing that I had in mind was to drink. And I began to run scared. Outwardly, it was fine. I can remember I would wake up in the morning and I would be shaking and I would be... I'd have cold beads of sweat on my forehead, and I would look in the mirror and I would say to myself, Grant, what are you doing with your life? But I'd straighten up and I'd say, you know what? I'm busy advising people. So I thought. If I can't handle my own life, my goodness, I'm advising all these people. If I can't handle my own life, there's something wrong. And with that, I would put on a clean shirt and a suit and a tie, and I'd walk out the front door. I'd meet my neighbor as he was heading out, and he'd say, Hi, Grant, how are you today? And I'd say, Great. And outwardly, I looked fine. And inwardly, I was crumbling, bit by bit. Deeper and deeper and deeper into this mire. I don't want to spend too long on it because I have a lot to tell you and I'm not going to over-talk my time this afternoon. But I can tell you that I finally reached a point where I was literally drinking to live and live to drink. I had a miracle happen in my life. I'm not going to take too long to tell you about what happened. I've given you some idea of what it used to be like. But what did happen was that in Swan River they had a curling bonspiel. And midway through that bonspiel they had a great big stag for all the curlers. And they had a door prize at that stag, a smoker, and it consisted of a Texas Mickey. Have you ever seen one of those? Beautiful. Rigged up in a stand, you tip the bottle over, and you gurgle it out into your glass, and then you straighten it up again. They were raffling this off as a door prize. Now, you people couldn't possibly guess who won that Texas Mickey. But I can remember talking to the secretary of the curling club. I hadn't been present when they had made the draw, so I said to him, Who won that gallon jug of whiskey? He said, We don't know. He must have been curling or something because he didn't claim it. So I hauled my tickets out, and he looked at them, and he said, By God, you've won it. And, well, if you can imagine, we were halfway through a week-long party, and to win a gallon jug halfway through a week-long party had to really be something. So I was immediately injected into a state of euphoria, except that He then said somebody dropped it and broke it. So there I was, right back into my state of depression. But in that few seconds, it's interesting how quickly we can change our attitude and our thinking. I took a proprietary interest in that in the stage of about 10 seconds, because I then became kind of haughty, and I said to him, well, what are we going to do about my whiskey? Hadn't owned it 10 seconds ago, now I want to know what we're going to do about it. Well, we struck a deal. He said, I'll deliver the equivalent in 26s, and for our American friends in the crowd, those are fifths. We call them a 26 up here. So I said, well, that's fine. Now, I don't know. I think the gallon jug with the stand and everything cost in those days maybe $40 or $50. So I said to him, get the cheapest booze you can. You know why. I said, I'll take it in the equivalent of 26. So he said, fine. Where will I deliver it? And I said, well, how about here in the Curly Drink? That's where we happen to be standing, having this conversation. He said, fine, I'll deliver it to you tomorrow at 2:00. Now, my friends, that was the first time in at least 5 years that I was ever on time for an appointment. I was there sharp at 2 p.m., and he produced this great big bag. Oh, he must have had two bags of booze. The first miracle in my life occurred within about an hour after. I got into the snake room, and they had long tables, not unlike the head table. They didn't have nice flowers or beautiful gals gracing it, but there were a bunch of guys sitting around it, and I had the booze set out, and I was making like the last of the big-time spenders. You know? Come on in. I was inviting everybody in. Come on in. Webster's having a party. My sponsor in AA walked into that room, and he was drinking a Coke. I can remember that. And I thought, why would he drink a Coke when there's all this free booze around? I'd done a lot of drinking with Ed in previous to his coming to AA, but I couldn't understand why he was only drinking a Coke. Now, I mention that because that tells you how much I knew about AA. Nothing. You see, it never occurred to me that it was the first drink. When you people started to talk to me when I first came to AA, you used to say to me, stay away from the first drink. And I used to think it was the last quart that did me, and it wasn't ever the first drink. So that never made sense to me, you see. So I couldn't understand why he was drinking this Coke. Now, he had been in the room about an hour, and remember this, all this booze that I just won, I knew nothing about AA. This is on the 29th of October, 1962. I called him over and I said, Ed, I think I want to do something about my drinking. Well, he nearly fell over, as you can readily appreciate. He said, come on, he said, I've got a room in the hotel. He didn't live in Swan River. He lived in another town not too far away, Yorkton, as a matter of fact, 120 miles away from Swan River. He said, come on to my hotel room and we'll have a talk. So he took me to the hotel room, and for 3 hours he talked. I don't see the big book up here, but anyway, he talked about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was quoting out of it, and he was telling me what a wonderful life he was leading and how great this program was. And I sat there, and I sagely nodded through all this. But I can tell you something. I don't remember a damn thing that he said. But I'll tell you something. The reason I mention it to you, he had a look on his face that I later came to identify as serenity. He had found something in that program. I didn't know what it was, but I could tell by the look on his face that whatever it was he had, boy, I sure wanted. But I was going to do it on my terms. You see, it's a funny thing. It's as if I want you to try and get the picture. It's as if you open the door and you've got a salesman standing there, and you sort of agree that you're going to buy his product, and then you try to close the door on him before you close the deal, but he's now got his foot in the door. Well, that was sort of like Ed. I let him in, but now I wanted to get him out again. I didn't really want this program. So for the next 3 days, I argued with him. And I was saying things to him like this, well, Ed, you keep talking about these AA meetings. I can't go to AA meetings. He said, why not? I said, because I'm a lawyer. Now, if you can tell me what the hell that has to do with whether or not I go to AA, I don't know, but to me that was very important. I said, what are my friends going to think? And oh my God, we've worked that one to death. I said, I'm going to be bored to tears if I join that outfit. You're asking me to give up my life. I might as well give you my arms and my legs if I'm going to give up booze. And he just smiled at me. He said, well, I think you're going to have to get to meetings. I stayed sober for 5 days. He had gone back to Yorkton. It's now a Tuesday evening. I had stopped. I'd had my last drink on the Thursday. So it was Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. Tuesday night, the phone rang. Little did I know that my friend Ed had been working with the AA guys locally. See? The mealy-mouthed snitch that he was. I pick up the phone, and a voice says, hi, it's Stan speaking. And I said, hi, Stan. And underneath I said, oh, God. He said, yeah, we're having our meeting tonight. Would you like to come? We'll pick you up. And I said, Stan, I've got this thing made. The words that will echo down the halls of the ages. How many in this room have said that? Ah, I've got it made. I don't crave the stuff. No. But you see, we're blabbermouths. We're windbags. I couldn't leave well enough alone. I said to him, and besides, there's an important hockey game on TV. The NHL playoffs are on, so I'm going to watch the game. You fellas go ahead and have your meeting, and everything will be fine. And he said, okay. And we hung up, and I sat down, and I said, geez, Ed's been working on me all this time to try and get me to go to that outfit. And I didn't even have to work to snow him. He expects me to associate with a bunch of dumpkins like that. That's later the phone rang. It's a small group in Swan River, 6-8 guys maybe. And it's Stan again. He said, Grant? I said, yeah. He says, Stan again. I said, yeah, I recognize the voice. He says, listen, I've checked with the other guys, and they thought that they would like to go to watch that game on the tube, so we're going to watch the hockey game, and then we're going to have the meeting. Can we pick you up then? And I said, I'll get to the damn thing myself. And I went to that meeting at 10 o'clock at night. The AA club room is an old house 2 blocks off the main drag in Swan River. Swan River is just a small town in northwestern Manitoba. You know where I parked? A block and a half away from the club room. I got out of the car. It's a lovely April evening. I'm wearing my trench coat. I flipped up my collar. I look like Agent 007. And I started that long trek from the car. I'm looking up and down to see if anybody's watching. You know Sylvester the Pussycat and after Tweety Bird? You know how Sylvester gets up on his tippy toes? Then he hunches his back. That was old High Pockets Webster going to his first meeting. My story doesn't get very pleasant from here on in, but I do have one pleasant thing to tell you. I made it to the front gate, and I took a look at the sidewalk, and my God, it seemed to stretch forever. But I made it. I got to the door, and that had to be the heaviest door that I've ever pushed open. But I walked in, and let me tell you something. You people were sitting there, and you smiled at me, and you said, "Hi, Grant, we've been waiting for you." I'm firmly convinced that anybody that, quote, makes it, unquote, in this marvelous fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous has to experience something which I call surrender. There has to be an inflation of the ego at depth. There has to be a realization to the very core of one's being that he cannot ever safely drink again. And I am so pleased and so grateful to tell you that within 5 minutes after I'd been in that room, my surrender occurred. And from that moment on, I have never looked back. Thanks be to God as he expresses himself through you people. My problems weren't over. Now that I was sober, I got down to business and I tried to get my law practice back in order. I worked night and day. I knew I was in trouble financially. I knew that I had fouled up clients' funds. There's an attorney that spoke at the Winnipeg conference a few years ago. He said he called it, when he was drinking, a co-mingling of funds. That's when you get your own money mixed up with the client. I worked desperately to get it straightened up, but it wasn't to be. In July of 1962, 3 months after I came to you people, I walked into my office one day, and the Law Society of Manitoba were waiting there for me. And they'd been trying to catch me for 2 years. They took one look at my book, and they closed my office. I was out of business. In September of that year, I had to appear before the Discipline Committee of the Law Society of Manitoba, and I was disbarred and struck from the roll. At the same time, the Attorney General's Department in Manitoba was taking a look at all this mess, and they decided the charges had to be laid. In January of 1963, now remember, I had my last drink in March of 62, so I've been with you people at that point about 9 months. In January of 1963, I had to appear in court in Swan River. Not behind the bench this time, but in front of it. And I pleaded guilty to 15 charges of theft of money belonging to other people. The magistrate, I think, exhibited some amount of foresight, particularly in those days when AA was not as widely known as it is today. He said, "From what I've been able to understand," he said, "this man seems to be trying to do something about his drinking problem, and I don't think that there's any real merit in sending him to jail for any length of period. He said, I think it would be better if he served a short jail term, which I'm required to do, but we'll make it short and we'll impose heavy fines along with a short jail sentence. He imposed fines which totaled approximately $10,000. That's a fair amount of cash today, but let me tell you, in those days, that was a hell of a hanging out of your pants. The NCO in charge of the RCMP detachment in Swan River was a member of AA. After sentence had been passed, he took me by the arm. He said, come on, Grant. I'm now a guest of Her Majesty the Queen. He had his apartment over the... I keep hitting that damn thing. It's going to break my arm or something one of these times. The NCO in charge of that detachment had an apartment up above the RCMP quarters. And when I got there, his wife, and I'm sorry to report she just died a couple of weeks ago, but his wife had the most beautiful steak dinner ready for me. And that was my first meal as a guest of the government, a beautiful steak dinner. But it got around the time, and he said, well, I guess you have to go now, Grant. And I said, yeah, I guess the time has come. I was to do my time that had been sentenced that afternoon in the Dawson Jail in Manitoba. And we started out, they put me in a patrol car in the back seat, and the two constables started out. Father Hillary won't know about our cold weather in January, but I'll tell you something. A January night in Manitoba can be cold. It was about 30 below. We got down to the Dawson Jail. They marched me in. They had already turned the lights out in the jail portion. It's a very small jail. It's just one room with cells around the outside. Now, I have to digress just momentarily to tell you something. While I had been magistrate, there had been an Indian chap who had appeared before me at once. He had appeared before me 35 times. In those days, public drunkenness was an offense, and one either paid the fine, or alternatively, if you could not pay the fine, then you did 5, 10, 15 days in jail, whatever the court ordered. This fellow Ambrose was up before me, as I say, at least 35 times. Okay, back to my story. They wheel me in, and they snap on the lights. And, of course, all the guys in jail sit up to see who's coming in. And the first face I see is Ambrose. And I thought, my God, my time's come. Now, again, I'm dressed in a suit and my winter overcoat and everything, and they said, take that cell over there. We'll give you your jail clothes in the morning. And I walked over, and they clanged that door shut. I know there are a lot of drunks in this room who have done jail time. I'm not telling anything new here, but that's a terrible sound when that door clangs shut behind you. I've never spent a more devastating, lonely night. I prayed all night to the God of my understanding, and I knew that you people, although you couldn't physically be with me, were very, very close to me in spirit. They turned the lights out again, but they left the radio blaring, and every 5 minutes they'd come on with the announcement about this ex-magistrate that had been convicted. The next morning, the guard came in. He said, everybody up. It's time for breakfast. And he pointed at me and said, you too, come on. I said, well, I can't. I said, I'm too ill. I can't go. He said, we don't allow anybody up here alone. You've got to come down and eat breakfast. I said, I can't even stand up. He said, well, all right, we'll leave you up here. It's against the rules. But don't you move out of that cell, which had to be an idiotic statement. I couldn't even stand up, let alone move out of the cell. The gang went down for breakfast, and a few minutes later, I was sitting there holding my head in that manner with my elbows on my knees. And I sent somebody at the door. They, oh, by the way, they unlock all the cell doors during the day. They lock them just at night. And I looked up, and there was Ambrose standing there. I don't know how much contact you as an individual have had with our Indian friends. My experience has been that they don't outwardly show too much sign of emotion. They have a lot of feeling inside, but they're not going to let it show. But Ambrose had tears in his eyes. And Ambrose said to me, you shouldn't be in here. And I said, Ambrose, I'm exactly where I should be. And he shook his head. He said, no, you shouldn't be in here. And I said, Ambrose, it's a long story, and I really don't feel like talking about it right now, but I'm exactly where I should be. And with that, he turned on his heel and he walked away. A few minutes later, I looked up and Ambrose was back, and this time he had a newspaper rolled up under his arm. He said, take this. I took it. I opened it. And it was a piece of lemon meringue pie. This man had gone back down into that dining room. And he had taken this pie and wrapped it up. And he brought it up to me. And he said, try to eat what you can of this. He said, having an empty stomach isn't going to make it any easier. I understand that Ambrose is now in Winnipeg. I have never seen him from that day to this, but I have to tell you something. I have to find that man, and I have to take his hand in both of mine, and I have to try to tell him in whatever meager words that I'm able to muster how much he meant to me at that the lowest point of my life. God is infinite. He's all loving. He's marvelous. We have no conception of the infinity of this wisdom. He took this man who had appeared before me 35 times, and through that man came the channel that was to sustain me at that particular moment. The Crown were not very happy with this sentence that I've described to you, and they appealed it. So 3 weeks later, I was in the Court of Appeal in Winnipeg. I was led down the halls of the law court building. I had walked those halls in the robes of office, only this time I was handcuffed. They took me into the Court of Appeal. 5 judges. They listened to the story and they said 3.5 years, Stony Mountain Penitentiary. My first night after that was in Headingley Jail, which is a provincial jail. They send you there and then they ship you on to Stony after that. Everybody, all the way through my time in jail, everybody was concerned because they thought that I was going to be done in. Not because me as an individual, but what I stood for. I was an ex-judge, and they thought these cons were going to do me in. So everywhere that I went, I walked into Headingley, and the chief guard said, are you scared? I said, yeah, I'm scared. They said, well, fine, we'll put you in that cell block over there, If they come after you, yell, and we'll get over as soon as we can. I don't want to dwell too long on this because I'm rapidly running out of time. But I did 14 months on a 3.5-year jail sentence. I was paroled on the 1st of April, 1964. I didn't know where I was going to go, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I was absolutely bankrupt in every way, except that I had you people. And I clung to sobriety like I have clung to nothing else. I got a job working in a sheltered workshop, working with people who had been in the mental hospital. From there, I worked in what they call the Department of Rehabilitation Services, which is a branch of the Department of Health. From there, I was appointed some 18 months after I was paroled. I was appointed director of the Alcoholism Foundation of Manitoba. I served in that role for approximately 9 years, and they were great because I met so many people during that period of time. And I got to know so many people in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of that contact. I then spent 2 years in Regina. I see friends from Regina here. I spent 2 years in Regina with the Alcoholism Commission of Saskatchewan. We then moved out to Victoria. I had an opportunity to work in a private alcoholism treatment center. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get it off the ground at that time, so we decided, my wife and I should mention too, I'm hurrying along here, but I should mention that I was divorced and remarried during all this time. And my wife and I decided to return to Winnipeg. Now, it was really she who got me thinking about something called reinstatement. I couldn't allow myself to think about it, and I have to take a moment to tell you that when you're disbarred in Manitoba, it's a very, very serious thing. It's a lifetime thing. Nobody gets taken back. You are just booted out in disgrace and dishonor, and there is just no way. But they do have provisions that you've, in the Law Society Act, that you can apply if you want, you know, but they're not likely to do anything. So for the first time in many years, I allowed myself to think about it. I made my application in August of 1976. I walked in expecting to have 3 or 4 lawyers there to discuss this with me. There were 15. 30 beady eyeballs looking at me. And they kept me there for 4 hours. And then they said, well, we're going to have to think about it. And on September 28th, about 6 weeks later, September 28th, 1976, I got word that I had been reinstated in the Law Society of Manitoba. Now, what that means is that my name is added to the rolls as a barrister and solicitor, but as a non-practicing member. I crossed them up because I said I want certification too. That really threw them. That means that I can hang out my shingle again. So they've laid down certain conditions that I won't go into, but I've been working at it. And I'm still working at it. But interestingly enough, you'll get a kick out of this. Part of what I have to do is work in the Attorney General's Department. That's where I'm located now. So I'm working with the very people that threw me in the slammer in the first place. And there's got to be some kind of poetic justice in that, I'll tell you. But I'm still working at it. And I have one final thing to tell you about this story because I think it's such a beautiful part of something that's been happening to me. In August of this year, just a couple of months ago. I was invited back to speak at a roundup in Swan River, where all this had taken place. And interestingly enough, it was the public meeting, the Sunday afternoon meeting. And I got there, and there was one of my old friends. He doesn't have a problem with booze, but he was waiting at the door for me when I walked in to speak. I had on the same suit then that I have on now, by the way, I might add that. And, of course, I was delighted to see him, and I think he was pleased to see me. And he said, "I've got a gift for you." And he had it under his arm. It was a long thing, and it was all nicely wrapped, and it had Grant W. written on the side. And I said, "Well, gee, that's great, Ken." He said, "But I better tell you what it is, because," he said, "you may have mixed feelings about it." I said, "Well, fire away." He said, "It's your old law office sign." I had a sign that hung out over the street in front of my office, and it said, J.G. Webster, LLB, Law Office. Now, when they closed my office and they cleaned it out, somebody took that sign and threw it into the garbage can. And the reason I know that is that he told me. He and his wife lived in an apartment, and they were able to look down, and they could see the end of this sign sticking out of the garbage can. And he went down and he retrieved it. And he has held on to that sign for nearly 16 years. And when he heard that I'd been reinstated, he met me at the door and he told me this story. And he said, "I think you should have your sign back again." I think that's kind of beautiful. But let me tell you something. I have gone full circle. I have tasted the bitterness of defeat. I know what it means to go as low as anybody would care to go. I'm not proud of the things that I did as a result of my drinking. But I have come full circle. And through the grace of Almighty God, and through the love that you have been able to bestow on me, I have been restored. Now I'll tell you this, but that is not any particular credit to Grant Webster. But I can frame it to you as a question. Where would I be without this program? Where would I be without the marvelous program of Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, I would really like to go on for another hour and talk about the 12 steps and the whole bit, but we're running short of time, so I'm going to close with something that I always close with. It's entitled "To a Friend." And I would like you to think of this as coming from me, in a sense, like beautiful music. Do you have a favorite record that you're able to play over and over again, and you never tire of it? This is what this means to me. I can talk all I want about the AA program. I can try and tell you what it's done for my life. I can try and tell you that I would like my walk to match my talk. Do you remember, those of you that are old enough, the gospel singer, Edward McHugh? He used to start his program every day with a song. If I have wounded any soul today, if I have caused one foot to go astray, if I have walked in my own willful way, dear Lord, please forgive. And what I'm going to read to you is my expression to you of how I feel about an almighty, infinite, loving God as he manifests himself through you people. I love you. Aren't those beautiful words? In a world that in many respects is going insane, isn't it something that we can say that? I love you not only for what you are, but what I am when I am with you. I love you not only for what you have made of yourself, but what you are making of me. I love you for the part of me that you bring out. I love you for putting your hand into my heaped up heart and passing over all the foolish and frivolous and weak things that you can't help seeing dimly there, and for drawing out into the light all the beautiful, radiance, belonging that no one else had looked quite far enough to find. I love you for ignoring the possibilities of the fool and weakling in me, and for laying firm hold on the possibilities of the good in me. I love you for closing your ears to the discord in me, and for adding to the music in me by worshipful listening. I love you because you are helping me to make of the timber of my life not a tavern, but a temple, and the words of my everyday not a reproach, but a song. I love you because you have done more than any creed could have done to make me happy. You have done it without a touch, without a word, without a sign. You have done it first by being yourself. After all, perhaps this is what being a friend means. And to you, my friends, may I close simply by saying this, that you have been a delightfully attentive audience. You have heard many speakers. I'm sure you have been inspired by what you have heard this weekend. And I'm so grateful that you have taken the time to be a part of my sharing this afternoon. And may I just say this, that my name is Grant, and I am indeed a very, very grateful alcoholic. God bless you and thank you.